Hello there, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page. This is our post-Derby Festival edition. We shall be looking back on classic victories for Lambourne and Minnehawk, discussing a crowd crisis in relation to the Derby, and much, much more. I am Lee Mottershead. I'm joined by my colleagues Chris Cook here in the studio. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Lee. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. And Liam Head, back in Manchester at the moment. How are you, Liam?
Hi, Lee. All good.
Right, let's crack on then with the Derby, the world's greatest flat race, the Premier Classic, and once again won on Saturday by Aidan O'Brien. For the 11th time, he was victorious in the Derby, and for the third consecutive year, but not with his number one, the whale-backed Delacroix, but Chris, with Lambourne, who led from go to woe, and truth be told, never looked like getting beaten.
No, it's a funny race, isn't it? My line on this is how disappointing all those market leaders were, because for the last 3 weeks building up the race, it seemed to me that we were focusing in on the four big names at the top of the market, right? You had Delacroix, we put his name in the frame with those two wins at Leopardstown, Lion in the winter, being there all winter. Pride of Arras, who put his name in the frame by winning the Dante. And then Ruling Court, the Guineas winner, who didn't even turn up in the end, which I thought was nearly the oddest thing about the whole race, because it was hardly a quagmire. You know, it was officially good going when they ran that race. I could see why he might be worried about rain coming, but there was no additional rain on the day. And then I wonder if it got off when they were looking at that result and thinking, actually, that's quite a winnable Derby, even if you've got a horse that doesn't necessarily stay every inch of it. If he's got Guineas-type class, you know, he might have shown up to quite good effect in that race.
But it was odd because Charlie Appleby had made clear on Friday afternoon that if the deluge came, they would have to think hard.
Right.
But the deluge didn't really come, and yet all through Saturday sort of lunchtime onwards, it felt like there was an expectation that he wasn't going to run.
I think they've just got caught up thinking about what's happened to Desert Flower. She got beaten in the Oaks. They were obviously very hopeful that she would stay, and then she didn't. And then the ground became the reason for them, in their minds, why that didn't work. And then I think they're starting to think, well, if the ground hasn't worked for one Guineas winner, maybe it's not going to work for the other one. Let's just pull them and go to Ascot. I think going straight to Ascot is always a very valid choice if you've got a Guineas winner, right? You know, if you go to the Derby, there's a major risk that you're not going to stay. But it did seem weird to commit to the Derby right up until 90 minutes before and then hook it, even though there hadn't been a drop of rain that day. And as I say, in the end, he'd have run in the four, wouldn't he?
Well, bearing in mind the point that you made about all the fancied horses not really running their races, how do we know what would have happened?
No, of course.
Liam, first question to you. As the Racing Post Lambourne correspondent, you must be sitting there in a room full of cash after Lambourne won the Derby.
you'd like to think so, but stupidly, I was one of a few people who didn't actually take advantage of the name and back Lambourne for the Derby, annoyingly. But like you said, what a great performance from the horse to lead from start to finish, and really just quickened as the race went on. You kind of thought that there was sort of halfway out that, you know, the challenge was going to be thrown down to him from a number of horses in behind, but he just quickened so well under Wayne Lorden and just proved again why he is such a genuine stayer. So for Aidan O'Brien to again win this race is fantastic for him and his team. You know, they put so much effort into these classics. So it was a really, really good performance from his team. But as you mentioned as well, and as Chris mentioned about the favourites, you do have to give a lot of credit to those massive prices behind. I mean, you know, the likes of Lazy Griff, 50-1. You know, there was a 28-1 third, a 50-1 fourth. So it was great. And it just shows you that, you know, given how big, how competitive the field was. There was 18 runners in the end, which was great to see. It was just such a wide open race in behind.
Yeah, and I mean, Liam, Lazy Griff in second, for me, that juxtaposition of the world's most powerful and influential racing operation with the winner in front of a second who has 24 owners. I spoke to a retired quantity surveyor from Middlesbrough who was talking about the best day of his life to finish second.
Wow.
in the Derby.
Even better than Quantity Surveying.
Even better than that.
I can't believe it.
I mean, that was great. I mean, because that's what you won, isn't it? And then really, so the Derby, almost less than any other race, do you get that sort of story.
No, it's fantastic stuff. There were two syndicate horses in the race, and I was hoping they'd run well. Midland Park, a huge day for them. But there'll also be an extent to which they're thinking, you know, a lot of things have gone right for us here, and a lot of things have gone wrong for Aidan, and we still can't beat him. Yeah. He still managed to win the race somehow. So he had Delacroix, didn't he? But then I think those two Leopardstown races, I think he's the ninth horse to win both and then not win the Derby.
Had you made that point in the front runner going into those races?
They can make a horse look really good and you get carried away with it. And then Epsom is, of course, a completely different test. And of course, that was also true for the Dante winner. I've always thought of the Dantes being the best of the trials. But it didn't work out this time, that's sure. He turns out to be just a bit free. You know, he went down to the post in the Red Hood and then he's over-raced through the first half mile, giving himself no chance. But, you know, even in that context, what he did was very disappointing. He was beaten before even the turn for home.
Yeah, he was. And he wasn't alone.
No.
He wasn't alone in that. Having spent a lot of Friday mulling on, would we get the first Derby since at least 1919, because that's as far as John Michael Churchy, the ace Derby historian, can vouch for, where they might come across the stand side because of soft ground. They didn't. The deluge didn't come until, I don't know, half an hour or so after the race, when those of us sat in the media centre just heard this pummeling of rain on the roof, and then they did come across
for the last two races. Didn't they?
And Chris, you were making the point again today, what would have happened in the Derby had that rain come a bit sooner?
Well, I love a counterfactual.
Yes.
And of course, they messed about with the time of the Derby again, didn't they? It was 3:30 this year. It has been 4:30 reasonably reliably.
Right. So the Derby was probably impacted by England v, was it Andorra?
Andorra, yeah. I mean, I'm sort of on board to a certain extent in trying to accommodate TV, right? But we shouldn't be moving for a friendly game against Andorra. It was a friendly, wasn't it? I didn't really pay any attention to it. I felt a bit bad for the Derby in the first place that it was moving at all for a game like that. But then, yeah, if it had been run in its proper slot, or maybe even at 5 o'clock, you'd have had bordering on soft ground, and it might have been a bit different, because it is harder, isn't it, to make all the running in those circumstances. Yeah. You start to get tired, even if you've gone a sensible pace and the other horses have got a chance of reeling you in.
Before we move on to the other classic on Friday, quick question to you both. Lambourne, will he go down, or will he prove to be a very good winner, an average Derby winner, or a below par Derby winner?
I mean, the consensus has got to be that he's probably not a very good winner, is he? Circumstances have worked well for them there. You could imagine circumstances again working well for him in the Irish Derby. You would think that connections with the horses they have, they would be in a good place to influence the way that race is run. So maybe that'll work out for him again. But after that, I think, you know, that might be the end of his winning opportunities.
Lee, you more positive about Lambourne? You must be about Lambourne.
Well, I think what we know he stays, and we know he finishes his race is really strong. But as we've mentioned, you know, a lot of these big hitters, you know, that in the market, the likes of Delacroix, the Lion and Winter, Pride of Ours, they didn't really run their true race to what we've seen in the past. So we don't know really how good the opposition he'd be on the day. So it will be interesting to see the next time he turns out, to see sort of these rivalries are renewed again. So I thought it was a very good performance in terms of being a super Derby winner. The only time will tell, I guess.
Do you know what name came into my head over the weekend? And I mean, this is just a bit ridiculous, really, showing my age. Environment Friend won the Dante, stuffed at Epsom, and then won the Eclipse at like 28-1. There's not much more forgivable in the world than running badly at Epsom, right? I mean, it doesn't prove anything in terms of your long-term quality. So there's definitely going to be a couple of horses that finished out the back who are going to do better next time. It would be worth giving some chances to them, I think.
Okay, we'll remember that. Liam, Friday was a great day for, another great day for Aidan O'Brien, as Mini Hawk overhauled Whirl in the closing stages of the Oaks, not long after Jan Brueghel had beaten Calandigan in the Coronation Cup. What was your take from those?
Yeah, and I think it just really stamps the emphasis that Aidan O'Brien puts on these top-class races, you know, to win another Oaks and Coronation Cup, you know, back-to-back in such a short space of time with two genuinely class horse. But obviously, Jan Brugel won the Ledger last year, so there's no denying his class. And Mini Hawk, obviously, you know, won a very good Chester Vars, I think it was. You know, it's great to see that he's really targeting these big races. Mini Hawk has stayed on really well to overhaul her stablemate, and it was just a really pleasing performance, and gives you hope to see where she might go sort of over the next sort of 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, because if Aidan has got an arc horse among those three, Lamborn, Jan Brugel, or Mini Hawk, which is the one, or is it Los Angeles?
That is a very good question. I don't know if I really fancy any of them. But he's absolutely rammed with middle distance horses, isn't he? It kind of bothers me thinking about it, because one of the first questions to him was, you know, does Jan Brugel now go for the King George? And he was like, well, we've got Los Angeles for that, and if he turns up there, then nothing else will. And it's like, well, I mean, you think of Aidan as a guy who's prepared to run his horses against each other, the good ones.
Which he did at Epsom.
He definitely did, but maybe that only goes for the three-year-olds until we find out which ones, where the pecking order is, and then after that, you know, he's trying to build stallions, isn't he? We know what the job is that he's got. I wouldn't like to think that he's going to try and find different routes through the rest of the season for all of these quality middle distance horses. We need to see them bouncing off each other somewhere along the way.
What I think this did remind us, again, over the weekend, is the extent to which Ballydoll and Coolmore, I mean, they've always been obsessed with the Derby, and it's in the Derby's benefit that Coolmore still believe the Derby is the race to win. But the extent to which they prioritise the Derby and Oaks over the two Newmarket Guineas now, increasingly so.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really weird, because not that long ago, it felt like both those Guineas were kind of in his pocket, you know, because he would win both of them. 2, 3, 4 years in a row, and then it just stopped. And it's a long season, right, isn't it? And he's got international targets for his quality horses at the end of the year, so I guess he's starting them off a little bit later than he used to in order to make sure that they get all the way to the end of the season. And the result is that, you know, however good his two-year-olds look, you're daft if you're backing them for the 1,000 or 2,000 guineas, because, you know, on recent form, they're just not going to be sharp enough. They're not going to be ready. They might not even turn up for the race. Yeah. But then come Epsom time, it's a totally different story. So, I mean, you know, Godolphin were rampant in Newmarket, and it's been completely turned around. Yeah. Just on another note about the Coronation Cup, while the three of us are talking here, could we maybe do a sort of quick vote? Was Mikel Barcelona to blame for Calandagan getting beat? Because, you know, online that became quite a hot topic.
My initial take, just from watching the race live, was that he'd given the horse an awful lot to do, and it was not the first example this year of Mikel Barcelona perhaps underperforming in a big race. But after the race, he was saying, well, the horse just started slowly and there wasn't much you could do about it. My initial take was, yes, Ryan Moore had ridden a better race than Mikel Barcelona.
So I think you can definitely say that and yet still not really blame Barcelona, because, against Ryan Moore, lots of jockeys are going to look second best, right? I was just looking, initially I was annoyed, like you, but you look back at Calandagan's races and he does do this. You know, he takes too long to warm up into his races. And if he goes back to 10 furlongs in particular, that is going to continue to be a problem. He's been a beaten favourite his last three races. I think it's maybe the horse that's underperformed on this occasion rather than the jockey.
Good thing is, because he's a gelding, they can just keep trying.
Yeah, that is a great thing. Yeah. And I mean, he adds a lot of colour to every race, but I've definitely stopped backing him.
A little bit of a segue now. Was there a little too little colour at Epsom over the Derby Festival? Was it lacking a bit of va-va-voom and grandeur and sense of occasion? It was certainly lacking numbers this year, because there was a notable decline in the attendance at Epsom on Friday and Saturday year on year. Perhaps to put it in more context, so if you rewind back to the final pre-COVID year of 2019, the decline in attendance is pretty stark. Derby Day this year had 22,312 people in the paid enclosures. That was 41% down on the 38,044 from 2019. On Oaks Day, Builders Ladies Day at Epsom, the attendance was 15,133, which was 35% down
on the 23,166 achieved in 2019 when the Oaks Day attendance was greater than this year's Derby Day attendance. Those of us who spent time on the hill on Saturday or looked at the hill from elevated positions in the grandstand couldn't help but notice as well how quiet it was this year. I thought the hill was sparser than at any time I can remember, apart from obviously those COVID derby. There were fairground rides with almost no kids or no kids on them at all. The old market that used to sit towards the top of the hill wasn't even in attendance, wasn't even there this year. So there was definitely a quiet feeling to the hill. I thought in general terms there was perhaps a lack of a sense of occasion or grandeur about the derby this year. And certainly the relative comparison between that and Royal Ascot coming up, again, made the derby feel perhaps even a little bit down market this year compared to Ascot. For Epsom and the Jockey Club, it's clearly a big issue. They've been perfectly open in saying that Epsom needs to be more commercially successful. That's one reason why they've been exploring a different sort of derby festival in the future, with one proposal being for a week-long festival, which would include one extra midweek race day, staging the Coronation Cup with the Oaks and the Derby on consecutive Saturdays. That hasn't been implemented for 2026, but I think what happened over the weekend will make it ever more clearer to the Jockey Club that something needs to be done with the Derby Festival. New Group Chief Executive Jim Mullen was in attendance on Saturday, and I'm sure he and the new General Manager of Epsom, Jim Allen, came away with maybe a renewed sense of purpose in feeling that what should be a truly great festival is given a bit of a revival. Chris, watching from home, what was your take on that sort of aspect of the Derby Festival this year?
Watching from home, they are quite careful with their shots, aren't they? I mean, you've got a good sense of atmosphere.
Mm. Although ITV did mention more than once about the hill being quiet.
Yes, I was stuck on the more specialist channel. But I take the point. I have the sense that they've slightly given up on the hill. That's been a sort of continuing issue over a number of years. I think that's a mistake if that is what's happened. They need to sort of make an effort to make sure that looks like a proper party.
It's tricky, isn't it, the hill? Because, and I've had this discussion with the Epsom clerk, of course, Andrew Cooper, not long ago, in the sense that Epsom as an as a racecourse has been grappling with the hill for a long time, in the sense that how much attention and focus do you put on the hill, and how much investment do you put in the hill, knowing that on the one side, you're not going to get great commercial return because all the people who are on the hill don't pay any money towards the Jockey Club.
Yeah, but hardly any commercial.
Yeah, but at the same time, the hill is a real visual barometer of the health of the Derby. And as I said in the column today, this year that the health of the hill or the hill, the visual barometer made the Derby look poorly.
And I think also, if you're in the stands, and you probably paid quite a lot of money to get in there, the hill is what you're looking at. And so it becomes part of the show. And so I think they've just got to swallow that pill and accept that they've got to spend money on making that look busy and fun. It's a loss, but it's an investment. The people in the stand have got to feel they're part of a big one-off occasion. And that's what justifies the expense of that they're going to. Without that, they're going to start asking themselves, well, if nobody's over there, then what am I doing here?
Yeah.
And bearing in mind, it was pointed out in part of our paper today, that they're charging quite serious prices for children to get into those main stands. For the main stand, £70 for a five-year-old, that seems like a mistake to me, or certainly seems quite ambitious. They'll know themselves if they've got customers who are perfectly prepared to pay that. But if we're trying to encourage the next generation to begin bonding with the sport, I don't think that can be the way to go.
No, and although the weather was clearly a factor this year, there was a yellow weather warning in place for that part of Surrey. As we discussed earlier on, the rain didn't actually come until after the derby, but that the grim forecast will have put some people off from attending.
Bound to have done, yeah.
The Appleby Fair was taking place over the weekend. Obviously, Epsom traditionally on Derby Day has a big representation from the travelling community. For them, Appleby Fair is a big thing, so that might have made a difference, although that's in Cumbria, this is in Surrey. But even with those factors down and agreed, the Jockey Club aren't pretending that they wholly explain the attendance drop. And just in general terms, an event like the Derby, Derby Day, what tradition has been one of the great historic sporting occasions in Britain, should be getting more than 22,000 people through the paid enclosures.
Absolutely should, yes. I mean, when you start thinking about that and, you know, the other days racing that attract more than that, it's quite shocking, really. I mentioned earlier about, you know, our willingness to move the time of the Derby around, and it wasn't that long ago. Did we have it at 1:30 to avoid the football one time? That's clearly a mistake. You've got to show some pride in an event like the Derby, and if you show too much of a willingness to move it around, it makes you look a bit desperate, you know, and like desperation's the worst thing you can possibly reek of out of all the things you could reek of. So I think you choose a slot, and that's where it's going to be, you know, come hell or high water, and show the audience that has been following the sport for a long time that you still believe in it, and you're not going to bow the knee to just, you know, whatever other sport happens to take the broadcaster's fancy. In my view, it wouldn't have to be on a Saturday. You could move it to the Friday, couldn't you? You could make an Oaks and Derby doubleheader on the Friday and try and sort of take over the sports news agenda for that day, and maybe have the Coronation Cup on the Saturday if you still want to make it a two-day affair. I don't mind trying something like that, but you've got to pick a slot and then stick to it for a good number of years, and see if you can't sort of get people's attention that way.
Liam, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree with what Chris is saying. I mean, for years gone by, we've been so accustomed to, you know, the Grand National being at a certain point on a Saturday and a certain time of the year. So if you keep chopping and changing with the times of racing, I know obviously, as we mentioned, that the football's obviously impacted the timings of things. But you have to keep people sort of assured of when, you know, when things are going to take place. You know, for example, if a corner shop had different opening time, no one would ever know when it was open or shut. So you have to keep people believing, yeah, and letting people know when things are going to happen. And one thing I would also touch on, obviously I know that we mentioned that the weather's obviously had a big impact, but even just leading up through to the week, you know, I'd be watching, you know, ITV, and you would hardly see or hear of any, you know, trailers for the weekend, the Derby. There'd be more talk about Royal Ascot, or when we sort of come to January and February time, there might be clips of the Cheltenham Festival. So people know when these sort of major festivals are happening. I was out with some friends on Saturday evening, and we were talking about the racing, and none of them knew that the Derby even took place that day. This is obviously supposed to be one of our proper showcase meetings of the year, so I just think it needs to sort of drum up a bit more coverage in the weeks leading up to the race.
Yeah, I think people move on for this in a second. There certainly is an element, Chris, that I thought the marketing and promotion of Derby Day and the festival across many different platforms wasn't as good as you would have liked it to be. And even just if you go around London on the tube, you'd see loads of adverts for Royal Ascot. There was advertising for the Derby Festival, but again, relative to the advertising for Royal Ascot, it just looked a little less glitzy, a little less glamorous, a little bit cheaper.
Well, that's a real problem. I don't live anywhere near London these days, so I'm sort of slightly out of that, but that's all of a piece, isn't it, with the sport failing to accept its responsibilities in terms of marketing itself properly. You know, we talked about that recently. We've had the 3 million splurge, which may possibly have been misdirected, but I mean, that's the first serious spend from the sport for a very long time. We need to get better at projecting the sport, or the sport needs to get better at projecting itself, I should say.
Well, the good thing is that Jim Allen, who is the general manager of Epsom, this was his first Derby Festival in the job, he has made clear that he recognises there are serious issues that needs to be tackled, and he is going to attempt to do something about it. So hopefully by the time we get to next year, progress might have been made. We'll have to keep fingers crossed on that front. We will return after the break, when among the things we will be looking at is Lord Allen, the incoming, hopefully, potentially chair of the BHA, and what stakeholders in the sport think about his decision to delay his arrival in the big job. Welcome back to the front page, and we're going to start this half of the programme by focusing on what is the lead story in today's Monday's edition of the Racing Post and all over our digital coverage as well. It relates to Charles Allen, Lord Allen, the Labour peer, who last Monday was supposed to start as BHA chair, but has decided to delay his entry into the role so that he can have more conversations with stakeholders in the sport about his vision for British racing. At the heart, we believe, of Lord Allen's decision to delay beginning as BHA chair is he wants some commitment from stakeholders in racing about changes to the way the sport is run, changes to British racing's governance model, which at the moment, as in previous years and in previous incarnations, is beset by constipation and the power of vested interests putting the short-term goals of themselves or their organisations ahead of the long-term interests of British racing as a whole. It is believed that Lord Allen is trying to get assurances from certain elements within the sport that they would back his plans to do something about that. In relation to that then, at the Racing Post, we contacted in recent days all the sport's major stakeholders in terms of the participant groups. So in relation to trainers, jockeys, owners, breeders, racing staff, and we contacted every British racecourse or racecourse group to ask them questions about whether they supported Charles Allen's desire to change the sport's governance model. Chris Cook, what do they tell us or not tell us?
Well, we got sort of waves of concern, sometimes quite detailed concern from the various participant bodies, and quite a lot of silence from the racecourses. We heard from the large independents sharing some of the same concerns of the participant groups, but you know, the two largest groups, ARC and Jockey Club, have not responded. And the implication seems to be that, you know, in relative terms anyway, it's the racecourses that are comfortable with the status quo. They feel like they have enough power to influence the decisions that will suit them. And meanwhile, everyone else is jumping up and down saying, look, this the way things are does not work for us. It's been such a long-running theme in horse racing. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when the tripartite system was introduced to some fanfare, and you had quite, you know, experienced and astute observers of the racing scene talking about how this was going to be a significant breakthrough and was really going to help us. And then by the time you got to, what was it, 3 years ago when we moved to a new system, you know, everyone was slagging off the tripartite system and saying what a terrible idea it had been. And here we are only 3 years later trying to change things once again. I mean, I can't help wondering if there is actually an ideal way of doing things that we could possibly hit upon. There's talk of freeing up the BHA, you know, peopling it with independents who know about the game but have no attachments to any part of the game.
Yeah.
You know, good luck identifying those people. That sounds pretty difficult. And even if you could, you know, who appoints them and to whom are they accountable? You know, who can do the hiring and firing of those guys? It gets very difficult. I think there's an extent to which it's just a really difficult sport to lead. I mean, that's very old news. I think that then means you've really got to pick the right people. They've got to have, you know, the intelligence and the strategic sense to lead the sport in the right direction. They've got to have personal charisma as well to get everybody on the same page, even people who've been at each other's throats for years. That, I think, is what is going to help the sport in the long term. And, you know, we haven't had a leader like that for, well, over 10 years anyway, in my view. We just got to start, you know, picking the right people and putting them in the right slots. Isn't that the number one?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And, of course, the interesting thing is that I think many people seem to believe that Charles Allen is the right person, but it feels as though he's almost turned on some of those who appointed him by
right.
saying, look, I'm not happy with the structures that you put in place to run British racing. I want a BHA that is stronger and more able to take decisions without being held back by vested interests. Just to pick out some of the quotes from some of the stakeholders that we spoke to, Paul Strellis, PGA Chief Executive, the composition of the BHA board allows it to be, or creates a perception that it is swayed by vested interests. Paul, one of those who wants to see members taken off the BHA board. George McGrath, Chief Executive of the National Association of Racing Staff. This is a time to support Lord Allen and accept changes rather than looking back and pointing fingers. As you said, the large Indy race courses were seemingly very much behind Lord Allen's plans or intentions to change governance.
Yeah.
And Jim Mullen, the Jockey Club Chief Executive, also spoke to that effect at Epsom on Friday. David Hunter, representing a smaller race course, Fakenham, an independent race course, said the leadership vacuum is damaging, the ship is rudderless, and day-to-day decisions are taking far too long. Liam, it's all interesting stuff, and you'd imagine if you are Charles Allen watching this play out, you'll be reading all this very closely, seeing what people say or what people don't say in advance of making your decision. Do I come or do I not come?
Yeah, 100%. You know, we've obviously been thrown into, you know, a sense of doubt, the fact that he was supposed to start last Monday, but hasn't. We're none the wiser of when he might take up that position. Obviously, there's a lot of things that need to be sorted before he actually steps into that role. But it is a concern, the fact that it's so up in the air as to what will happen. It is more of a concern, the fact that when he was sort of appointed in this role, you know, to take over at this point back in November, the governance sort of hasn't changed an awful lot. So he'll obviously want to make sure that everything is as it were when he takes the role up, if he takes the role up. But it is worrying how we've got to this point, and you know, everyone's none the wiser.
Yeah, the only thing I was going to say is, you know, this is a time when racing really needs friends in government. You know, with stuff being talked about like harmonisation of betting tax, and you know, he really could have been that guy, sort of straight route to Labour bigwigs. But you know, the fact that he's not in the door, may never get in the door, is for that reason, it's just another thing to worry about, you know?
Yeah, the optics of this with government aren't great. I suppose that the hope is simply that Charles Allen is playing a game of poker, and a lot of people in the sport will be hoping he has the winning hand.
Like it.
So we are going to end this week's edition with a feature that we introduced last week. It's called Four Stories in 4 Minutes. It does what it says in the tin. Chris, I'm going to start to you, asking if you can talk for a minute without hesitation, repetition or deviation.
Wait, you didn't say that before.
We can leave that a bit. On the subject of Jim Mullen, the new Group Chief Executive of the Jockey Club. He's had his first week in the job,
yeah,
and he was talking at Epsom on Friday.
Yes, there's been some speculation about, you know, maybe he's been brought in to make some difficult decisions, and he did accept in his discussion with Bill Barber on Oaks Day that he's perfectly prepared to make hard decisions. He, you know, gave no particular flavour about what form that might take. Obviously, I think they have 15 race courses at the Jockey Club. Yeah. I think we generally still take the view that the Jockey Club is a sort of good caretaker of the tracks that it has. You know, it always adds something, especially when it takes the new tracks on board. It would be a shame to see them lose any of those. They're all sort of linked to quite important communities for horse racing. Nevertheless, you know, he's making the point that the bottom line has got to work. He's only just in the door. He's not going to be in a position anytime soon to announce what his plans are. But he's there, and he's talking quite a good game about, you know, the upsides to horse racing and how well Oaks Day was working. But down the road, there's going to be some hard-nosed discussions going on behind the scenes at the Jockey Club.
And he's also made clear his view that the government needs to be very careful with its intentions regarding tax harmonisation. Liam, we move to you next, and Judmont have got a new retained rider, and it's not a huge surprise as to who that is.
No, Colin Keane's obviously been given that massive opportunity. We've seen what he's done over these last few years at the top class jockey. Obviously, we've seen what he did with Field of Gold in the Irish Guineas. I think it's really important progress this for Judmont, because obviously we've seen over the years the likes of Richard Hughes and so on have been the retained jockey, but obviously over the last few years they haven't had that sort of responsibility for one person. They've kind of used sort of the best sort of jockey available. Colin Keane has obviously been in that position and riding for the operation a few times when he's sort of obviously riding for Gear Lions. Important step, and it sort of fills everyone with a surety now going forward. The fact that whenever Judd Mantle have got a runner, be it in Britain or Ireland, then Colin Keane is the man. So good news all round.
I'm telling you, he's got some great horses to look forward to. Chris, many of those horses will be running at Royal Ascot, Field of Gold being an obvious one in the St James's Palace Stakes. And we are now just a week away from the Royal Meeting.
Yeah, it's great. If you're feeling at all on a downer after all the racing at the weekend being over, it's only another week to wait for an absolute glut of Group 1s. And you've got that amazing day's racing on the Tuesday that starts Royal Ascot next week. With the Queen Anne and the King Charles, as it is now, the King Stand, yeah, as it was, St James's Palace Stakes, the Coventry. It's probably the best way to start any major race meeting, I think. And just some really good clashes, some big names to look forward to. The one that's at the top of my list is the Prince of Wales on Wednesday. It's a race I always enjoy, really. But it's a rematch between Los Angeles and Anmat, who had that great race in the Tattersall School Cup at the Curragh just the other day. I really thought Anmat was coming to get him, but he just lacked a little bit of race fitness. And, you know, Los Angeles, to give him his due, is a tough horse to pass. I really, really strongly believe and hope that Anmat is going to turn it around this time. That would be another big day for Owen Burrows, who, he's in the last couple of years, I think he's really done quite impressive things with the horses he's got, and maybe deserves a bigger reputation than he's got. There's the mile division, both colts and fillies, so exciting. Field of Gold is back in the St James's Palace Stakes. Ruling Court now might be there to take him on. Henri Matisse is in there as well, and we've got that enigmatic French filly Zaragana going for the Coronation Stakes at the end of the week. It'd be nice to see her win a top class race in the style that she's always sort of suggested she could do, without relying on the stewards, without getting done by her stablemate on the line, as happened in the Boussac, just without controversy of any kind.
I'm hoping Falakai goes to that race, and I'm hoping Setono Rev wins for Japan on the Saturday. Someone who'll be watching that with great interest, I'm sure, Liam, is the king and queen both due at Royal Ascot, and the Queen was at Hexham on Thursday.
She was, yeah. Rare visit to the track to open up a stand. Obviously, there was no race in there at the track, but it was reassuring to see that she was there speaking to a lot of trainers and stable staff and so on. You know, really emphasises the relationship that the royal family have with the sport. So for her to sort of speak to these trainers through, the issues in the sport we have, and all the good things that come with the sport as well. So it was really great to see her in attendance there, and hopefully it can sort of showcase to everyone how important the royals are to this sport going forward. So as you mentioned, they'll be there, both the Queen and the King will be there at the royal meeting, and it adds a bit more colour to what is such a fantastic 5 days.
Fabulous. Yes, here to all that. I think we're done. We've done an awful lot of talking about an awful lot of racing, an awful lot coming up with Royal Ascot just around the corner, as Chris was saying. Chris, thank you for your input today.
Pleasure.
Liam, thanks to you in Manchester. Thank you to you all for watching. We shall return next week when Royal Ascot will be within touching distance. Until then, bye-bye.